You're just moments away from a conversation with a returning guest, Dr. Chris Draper. He's the author of Velocity Economics. Now, we're going to start out talking about trickle-up economics, how that works better than trickle-down, and then launch into a new technology advancement that Dr. Draper says will revolutionize how we store and maintain documents and fight deep fakes. Hang on. Lots to unpack here. Insight on Business, the News Hour, is made possible through the support of Taro International. Your business and your career are impacted more by your command of personal skills, so much so that how you speak, act, and interact can make or break a career. Learn more from Taro International at TERO.com.
Insight on Business, the News Hour, is made possible through the support of the HR professionals at Oasis, a paychecks company. Learn how to grow your small business or nonprofit by outsourcing your HR and payroll functions. OasisAHR.com.
It is the Business News Hour. Welcome back. And we also get to welcome back a returning visitor to the Business News Hour. He is the author of something called Velocity Economics, one of the smartest people I happen to know on the planet. His name is Chris Draper. Dr. Draper, good to see you again, sir. How you been, man?
Thank you for the kind words. It's been good.
Yeah, it has been good. Let's just tickle everybody with Velocity Economics before we get into this new system that you're doing. Velocity Economics is, I guess in layman's terms, taking trickle-down economics and turning it on its head. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, the logic of trickle-down economics is if I take a government incentive and I give it to the top, that something might magically happen to everyone else. But we know through math, if I support the growth at the base of our economy, everyone will get richer faster. And that tries to put that concept into words that are understandable and usable for politicians, for policymakers, for individuals that want to say, I know trickle-down is not working. It's never worked. We theoretically thought it worked once in 82, but it hasn't really to this day. And how do I actually give them a methodology, a strategy, a branding of what has always worked for us? What has been the form of capitalism that lets everyone get more work done, be more productive, yet also share in that growth?
You know, this is the silly season, as they call it in politics. We happen to be emanating from Iowa in the Des Moines metro area, and every single 2020 hopeful has been crisscrossing the state like crazy. And there are a couple, I think, individuals out there that understand this whole velocity economics idea. One, interestingly enough, he doesn't poll very high, but it's Andrew Yang, who seems to get it that if you infuse individuals with capital, they will be able to make a better case for themselves in the future.
Yeah, I think that the concepts of the universal basic income, where individuals are most prosperous when they're hungry but not starving, that is something that I think Yang has hit straight on the head exactly. But when we're looking at other platforms and other policies and other focuses, you're looking at, ironically, Bernie Sanders 4 years ago when you're talking about velocity taxes within the market. This is another reflection of that. A lot of his policies, which are being labeled as socialist, are in many ways actually better for a capitalist society that wants to accelerate productivity, wants to accelerate growth. The Harris campaign, though, has a lot of pieces in what they're doing that are also reflective of how do we build the base stronger of our economy and not just be basing it on a reflection of the top's performance, which is when we're playing the game every day of what's the Dow at. We're literally betting on how the top is doing, which is fine as long as you're the top of a pyramid. It is not fine when you're on top of a house of cards.
It is called Velocity Economics, and we will have a link in this radio blog back to that blog and that particular conversation so you can learn more about that. Well, we should just take books of Velocity Economics and pass them out to the candidates that come through Iowa because it's a sound strategy, I think. But we're not here to talk about velocity, although I could do that for a long time. I think it's a fabulous idea. We're here to talk about something new that Trokit is underway. First of all, tell us about Trokit. What is that?
So Trokit is a cloud-based platform that silos all the communication around legally sensitive items. And it grew out of our work in the labor relations, arbitration, mediation space. And we're growing most right now in special education. anytime you have a bunch of different parties who have a legally sensitive document they need to collaborate on, our platform is able to keep that information secure, keep it clear, and eliminate all the emails, text messages, phone calls, which in the school space are equating to civil rights and FERPA violations daily in our schools.
And all of this has led you down a different path, but similar. And that has to do with data breaches. So let's talk a little bit about that. We have been inundated with data breach after data breach after data breach. Some Experian, for example, Target, for example, and all of these things that are going on out there where they're costing corporations huge amount of dollars in settlements, and also the general populace in trying to put their life together. And so what have you found?
So when we were looking at the problem that results in data breaches, there's two things to worry about in data breaches. The first is we always think about some Russian hacker is going to come in and break in and steal stuff.
Right.
And so we go with all the two-factor, and we've got all this encryption, we've got this IP tracking, all that, and that's fine. Except for when you really look at the operations of communication, when you look at the operations and management of data as we do it day to day, as a lawyer would look at it in a complex case, or as a special ed teacher is looking at it in the management of an IEP, an individualized educational plan, you're more likely at greater than 8-1 to have an individual who is the right person, got through your portal, and gets on your site and pulls the wrong data and gives it to the wrong person. That's your real data breach opportunity for solving the problem. And the problem is always going to exist. There will always be breaches. The challenge is we've always had these little breaches for decades, for generations, and they weren't a big deal, right? Like, for example, someone may have on the back of their laptop once in a while, they may have a Post-it note. And that Post-it note may just happen to have all their passwords. It might fall into the street one day, right?
Right.
Well, we know that seems sort of weird, but in the past, that wasn't that big a deal because we didn't know what computer it fell off. We didn't really know where you could actually insert those little pieces of information. And over time, the Post-it note just degrades, right? So our physical data was unable to be identified with where it could be used, and it would degrade. So you have this degradation and contextualization that did not exist, but does now.
And it does now how?
Because right now, with everything getting connected, with that little piece of number I have on the back of that little slip, if that's now a piece of data, if I've emailed those passwords to myself, and now that piece of data gets hacked, I now have all the contextualization of that little piece of scrap, which means that every one of those releases is bigger. In the special education space, when we're emailing IEPs around through when we're emailing IEPs around to different parents,
that's
and
individual people. Educational
apologies.
Correct.
Yes, and this affects 67,000 Iowans every year. It affects over 8.6 million students across our nation. It's 12-16% of our classrooms. 17.5% of Des Moines classrooms are having this information shipped around right now. In a lot of cases, on email. And if you release that information, what's really in there is the functional outcome of an individual's physical or mental condition, mental health condition.
So, which can be impactful for their entire life.
If you do not solve the problems that an individual has with being able to demonstrate their academic potential given their individual needs, you will economically disadvantage that individual by often on an average 12% off the median for the rest of their life.
Mm.
If you're talking about lack of productivity in a society, you're talking about unemployment rate, you need to fix special education. And you need to do it in a way where everyone is protected. Because if I start releasing this data accidentally, and it gets stored accidentally in places, and now it is able to be built back up into everything else about that student. If I've got my average class size in Iowa of, 30 kids or something, right? Maybe smaller in some classes. And I'm talking about 10-16% of these individuals. It doesn't take long with what we have nowadays when we connect all the dots to rebuild Jimmy's mental health from this specific class. And we don't know currently in the world, where does that go when all of a sudden I identify Jimmy's condition because I've rebuilt Jimmy's mental health because I've been lax in how I communicate the data within these large 16-person, 5 different interest group teams. We don't know what the long-term consequence is because right now we haven't really looked at while the American Bar Association identifies that digital data is fundamentally different than physical data, we're only starting to dip our toe into what is the value of a breach. The little breaches, because they can now, instead of that post-it note, be forgotten, stay forever, and they can be assembled into a picture. They can be contextualized, and they don't degrade, which means a post-it note, which may have been nothing, is now a minimum of a $15,000 lawsuit, or it could end up being that individual's lifetime degradation in wages because now they've been marked in some manner. There's a ton of, especially in special education, when you're talking about how we are disproportionately impacting Black and brown communities through language and behavioral misdiagnosis and then underserving them because our current system is not allowing working parents to be as engaged as they need to be. If I'm on three jobs and the school says, come to the school at 10 a.m. on Tuesday so we can have a three-hour meeting about your student, I'm pretty sure that that parent isn't a situation where they don't want to be engaged. They can't. And as long as we allow that system to remain, we will continue to economically disadvantage those communities. But if we are not careful in how we help give them access to online tools, to communication that is more diverse, since 2004, you did not need to sit in the same room for an IEP meeting. The change to IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, changed in 2004 so you can have these virtual meetings. These parents who can't make it on Tuesday can asynchronously engage in these meetings. We're not necessarily doing it, and because of that, we're not engaging everyone. But more importantly, when we are starting to do it, if we're doing that, if we're creating that engagement through emails, texts, phone calls, Google Docs, which is mining data, if we're providing through those tools, you have a more significant risk because right now we don't know how to deal with that data, and we don't know what the long-term costs of those breaches are because those breaches will happen.
So and that data is there forever.
It's never going to go away.
Yeah.
And that's what we found with the paper that I wrote with Professor Angie Raymond from Indiana University was if we applied a risk-based model to how we should be looking at these systems. So when we, you know, if you go into a school and say, hey, school, here's what you're using right now. You're using, you know, email and text message and everything else.
Dropbox and wherever it happens to be.
Yeah. I mean, you're using a system that isn't accounting for the human error rate that will happen. When you're doing that, there's going to be a certain probability that something happens, and it's going to have a known cost if it happens. Email right now, the error rate of email, we just did a recent follow-up study where your probability of sending an email to the wrong place over the course of a long engagement for your average person, it's on the order of 10 to 14%, right? Well, 10 to 14% of the time you're releasing data, and that data now is important. It could turn out to be assembled into a picture of someone's mental health that sticks with them publicly forever. Our argument in the paper is it is unethical to use a tool that has that type of an error rate when the cost of the value of the data that is released is that high. But what's interesting is when we're looking at that, you know, we believe while Trock solves that communication issue, gets us down to an area where you have reasonable risk in how you communicate. The two ways that you fix that issue of risk is you either reduce the probability of data being accessible to someone who can release it, or you change what data they can actually lose at once. So example, Target. So Professor Raymond was big into analyzing the Target breach. The Target breach a few years ago was the groups came through the HVAC system, and they got into the main database of Target. The reason they were able to get in was because the IT professionals came and they put a bunch of stops in, ways that you could stop, you know, reduce your probability breach, but they stopped a business because they're so difficult to use. So they just kept taking away and taking away and taking away. And then all of a sudden, you now have a direct line because you deactivated so many catches from the HVAC system to your credit cards. Because we had spent all our time. Over the last 20 years, we've been told, let's go to cloud, let's consolidate, let's make sure we can read data quicker. And so the entire tech industry is all focused on how do I connect data quicker, which is very good in certain situations, as long as you know who you trust. But there's going to be a balance, too. I don't want every breach to see everything. It's better if I know breaches will happen, that I'm only able to get into one section of the database, or I'm only able to get to a little segment if I have a natural firewall around pieces of data. That's one of our ideal ways to reduce the risk of these releases that are happening with the communication breaches that we're currently unable to avoid.
Our guest is Dr. Chris Draper. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about data breaches, the exposure to not only individuals in the mental and physical health arena, but also there are some business contexts here as well outside of education, yes?
Well, it's massive. I mean, anything that's dealing with lawyers, for example. This is where we were dealing with lawyers a lot within the education space. Trocht, for the near decade we've been existing, has been supporting the legal tech industry in a lot of ways. But what we're seeing in lawyers is not unique to lawyers. The IoT push we're seeing in buildings, what we're seeing now is data that used to be stored in silos is now being connected. For example, if I have a property investment firm that works with a bunch of property management companies, if one of those companies had a breach, it wasn't a big deal because there's only that company, right.
And
the real data was sitting on some guy's piece of notes in his pocket, and so it didn't really matter anyway, right? So you have these you always had these natural firewalls. As you start to see the rise of Yardi and you start to see other tools, I'm actually going through those natural firewalls. What it means is a breach in some, mom and pop property management place in Richmond, Virginia, might now give me access to one of my most valued clients in Sunnyvale, California, because that group there wants to actually control their HVAC within the room, and they hooked up to the backbone that's now connected into Yardi, so my after hours billing can be here, and all these innocuous connections that I've not thought about now provide me pathways into what becomes multi-billion-dollar breaches, and we need to be looking at what are the risks and how are we looking? Because there's 1,000 ways to solve this. Trocht is one way to solve the communication problem we have in special education, legal, and the commercial real estate space. But as we look at the risk of it, what we want to be doing is reducing probability of a breach, but fractionalizing our data to make sure that any breach isn't too big. And in the legal industry, they have been so resistant to consolidation and collaboration in their data. The legal industry is very risky in its communication. But ironically, what we found when we wrote this paper and started to really break down consequence cost, they're really safe from a storage perspective.
Because they're all over the place.
Because they haven't fixed their communication, they end up being actually really, really safe for storage.
So to paint a picture like this, I think this is fascinating. So let me see if I can boil this down into dumb speak for me. Because, again, I said you're one of the brightest guys on the planet, and I really am attempting to figure this out. All right. Let's say that I have various documents, and these documents all pertain to my business, whatever that business happens to be. But I end up putting those documents in separate shoeboxes in various places, maybe not in my office, but at my home, at my resort, it's hellacious to go ahead and gather all of that data and gather all those pieces, but highly unlikely somebody's going to get the entire Megillah, the entire program, by finding one box.
Correct.
Okay.
And the legal industry, in many ways, has a whole bunch of these digital shoeboxes all over.
Yeah.
And so breaking into one digital shoebox means I'm never going to get the full picture. I'm never going to contextualize all this data. I may pull one file. I'm like, oh, man, this file is great. But I don't know if that file is any good.
Right.
It may be that, that was a contract, there was an internal document, it turns out half of it's no good anymore.
So lots of wasted time and effort for nothing.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But the fact is, I cannot contextualize, and I've self-limited my breach because I'm using these digital shoeboxes. And the legal industry is doing this all over. You've got lawyers that are using their email to store stuff. They've got Dropbox. They've got 3 external drives. And it's all over the place. And that's ironically the safest way for it to be stored. The challenge is, now, in a world where I've gone from simple frauds or simple changes to now deep fakes, the question the court system is grappling with is, what's real? So when I get there and I say, hey, here's my digital file, and the other side says, that's fake, what do you do?
How do you prove it?
I'll say,
it's got a date on it.
Yep.
And that's my signature on there. So it's got a date and a signature. This is the original file. But
I'm sure that's going to work, but once that lawsuit's worth $50 million and you're the whistleblower right there, right? I'm pretty sure there's going to be a stakes a little higher, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure if you're the whistleblower who, when I joined the federal government, in the beginning of my career, the union rep came over and said, young man, they're going to tell you some weird stuff. They tell you something really weird. You print it off. You put it in an envelope. You certify mail it to yourself, and you just keep it. That's your chip for the future. You're like, all right, that sounds a little conspiratorial, but cool, right? So I've got a bunch of friends who have boxes of certified mail envelopes.
To themselves.
To themselves.
Because if anything ever goes to court, you can present that certified letter, which is time-stamped and dated and all that, and say, Your Honor, here's the proof of what I said back in 1997.
This existed. Inventors do it as well. So an inventor, they have a great idea. They write it down. You'll have your little inventions book. But more importantly, if you certify mail your inventions book to yourself, the court could come and say, that existed. It doesn't give you any special rights. It doesn't say, here, your copyright. It doesn't say it's no trademark or patent. But it does say, we can unequivocally believe, the courts will believe, that that document has been unaltered since it went in that envelope.
Wow. All right. So short of sending each other, or ourselves, certified mail, what has Truk done with regard to this scary thing about finding documents that are out there and then breaching them?
We've basically created the digital equivalent of certified mail. So what we've created is a blockchain network that is publicly owned by the individuals who are using it. And what we're able to do through the ecert.email portal, so just right now we're in private beta, but going to www.ecert.email will allow you to read the white papers, light papers, our decks on what we're doing. But when the portal goes live, what it will allow anyone to do, any inventor, whistleblower, artist, advocate, they can take any digital file, they can select that they want to select that file. It'll then take and identify where they want that file to be sent. And what our system will do is take the digital thumbprint of that file.
Because every digital piece does have a thumbprint.
Yep. And so what we do is take all that data of that file, we hash it into its thumbprint and save that thumbprint into a blockchain, which is then replicated in all other nodes in the network. So multiple people within the public will actually own that hash, which is not something you can rebuild. It just says later, if I have that file again and I hash it again, run it again, it will be that evidence that no byte in that file has changed at all. So this system will allow you to take any file, you'll hash it, you'll save that thumbprint, you'll then send it to you and anyone you want to send it to, the same way certified mail does. And you can save wherever you want. You can rename it. You can, you know, a lot of individuals have their own naming convention, like, oh, this was file such and such from this and I did this. And they get these long file names now that go on forever. But you can save wherever I want. Anything. And for 20 years, as soon as you come back and pull that back, rehash it, run it against our blockchain again, you'll be able to see that this file has not been modified since the time it was created, allowing a whistleblower to instead of have to say, oh yeah, I know I had this file and then the company deleted everything and then, yeah, just trust me, this is what it was. That whistleblower can now take that file and they see something weird. They can now send it to themselves in an email through our system. It comes back with the hash of that, with the location of it in our blockchain, and know if it ever comes to in the future, that file is going to be accessible no matter where they store it from then on. If they leave it on a thumb drive somewhere in a physical shoebox, they can then pull it back out, put it back in their computer, rehash, and prove that that file has been unaltered.
Dr. Chris Draper, ladies and gentlemen, we have unpacked a lot of stuff here, Chris.
I'm trying to be shorter.
I know, but this is a lot of stuff. I mean, we started with velocity economics, then we got into data breaches, and now we're into making sure that whatever document that we have, whether it's music, whether it's legal, whether it is patient records, whatever it if you're a whistleblower and you find something out there in government or in business that is shady, that you can make sure that those documents are always original in their original form. Yeah.
Yes. And there's ways to do these things to an extent currently, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm a whistleblower and someone comes to court and they challenge and say, oh, that document's been altered. Yeah, I could probably spend $20,000 to $30,000 for a forensic analyst to sort of sort through everything and say, well, we're pretty sure it's the right thing, right? Or in an instant for it's basically a dollar to save it within our system. It's 10 cents if it's under a megabyte to actually go verify it. You can go in 10 cents and say, this file has not been altered, and we can prove it. And all the other individuals within our network, which include the International Bar Organization, bought Node 3. One of our big advisors is American Bar Association, has the section head for dispute resolution, Linda Seeley, who's long time been in this space, is one of our advisors on the governance board. The governance is being run by, again, Professor Angie Raymond, who's one of the leaders in the world in her space for governance, legal governance in these spaces. We actually have been assembling a team quietly in stealth mode until... You know, until sort of now we're starting to get out there too. Well, and I think, right now we're in a private beta. We're going to be opening up referral based credits so people can use our portal. But the uses of the network itself, we have done something fundamentally different with the network where in your public blockchains, like your Bitcoins, we caught the Russians not because there was some address in there somewhere at the end of the day. It said, I'm at the GRU, right? What we're able to see was, we could see all their transactions because in a true public sense, all their transactions are public.
Right.
Well, if you're in the legal system and you're starting to save stuff into a public blockchain network, you can see all your lawyers' interactions with everyone else too. And as soon as you start to assemble one or two of those, I now have created context again. So when someone says, hey, I've got this public blockchain tool, it's going to be on Ethereum, and here's all the things it does, and it's going to put files in and take them out and everything else, either they're not being straightforward with what their tool's limitations are, or what they're really doing is consolidating data again in a dangerous manner.
Which is back to the beginning.
Back to our problem. And then they're also now making public who's associated with the transactions, which is a problem. So instead of having a fully public system, our nodes are all publicly owned and publicly governed, so the rules of what data goes in and how you can use it are publicly governed. But our actual operations of the network more reflect a private network where the communication is between node to node to node through simple APIs that people can integrate with. So any group can actually use use one of our nodes to engage their latest tech tool, but they get to keep the context. Mm. We don't take any context of the data. We just know which node sent it. We know what the hash of the data is. But by keeping that context separate, you cannot rebuild the breaches that we're seeing. We're seeing these breaches through what is the metadata, through the surface data, through that contextual data. We completely remove that out of our system, and it stays with the operator in a way that as well is now done at a known cost. Every time someone wants to write a hash into our network, it costs 24 cents. Every other node gets 2 cents of that 24 cents. So if someone just buys a node and doesn't do anything with it, they make 2 cents every time someone writes into the network to make sure they can run their servers and operate. But anytime someone actually wants to write, it's only 24 cents to write a hash, which means unlike our cryptocurrency-based exchanges, where 1 month I can run my startup,
right,
the crypto value is at one thing, and then all of a sudden I have hyperinflation in South America, which actually causes Bitcoin prices to skyrocket. It turns out, I can't run my startup anymore because I don't know what the price is. So we're able to have predictable costing, non-contextualizable writing into what we're calling a neo-public blockchain network that is owned by actual human beings, that is governed by actual human beings, and is able to provide truth of data instantly for individuals regardless of what their actual value is.
His name is, his name is Dr. Chris Draper. Lots of stuff, Chris. Lots of things to, and we will have links to all of this up on the radio blog so that you can find out more information about this in beta form right now, but soon to be able to roll out as you get closer and closer to perfecting this, yes?
Yep. So in the coming 2 weeks, we're going to start being able to email individuals, and if someone gets referred in, they can refer other people in. They get extra credit to play around with our portal during that period of time. And our rollout target day is October 1st, where people can buy credit and use it no matter whether you've been referred or not.
And once again, just to be clear, target individuals for this would be who?
Target individuals that we see, the ones that we see are going to be individuals who are innovators, inventors, artists, individuals, anyone who thinks that they've got something so good that someone's going to someday potentially take them to court to modify something. If you've got the next great invention, instead of certifying mailing it to yourself, you can now just send yourself an email and have it hashed on the way, so you can always prove that that document has been unaltered.
Fascinating stuff. Chris, thanks so very much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, that was Dr. Chris Draper, the author of Velocity Economics, talking about deep fakes, how to prove a document is the correct document, the original document. Important not only for the legal community, but also creators everywhere. And we'll have links to Dr. Draper's website up on our radio blog. Well, that about wraps it up for another day. Thanks so very much for joining us. For all of us associated with the Business News Hour, Chap Ramsey is our production coordinator. Sales and marketing falls to Aaron Libby. The voice of the Business News Hour is Hunter Pease. And the music you're listening to right now is arranged, composed, and conducted by our friend James Goodlett, exclusively for the Business News Hour from Jam Good Productions. For all those folks and for Dr. Chris Draper, my name's Michael Libby. Have yourself a wonderful day. Be safe, be well, be careful. Most of all, be good to your fellow man. Good day.